I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is December 21st, 2008, the shortest day of the year. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today, backward satanic messages, also known as backmasking, an alleged practice of certain evil people, especially rock musicians, of saying or singing words which, when listened to backward, contain evil messages such as, "My sweet Satan," or "Kill yourself." Or they might contain messages such as, "It's fun to smoke marijuana," or "Sleep with me, I'm not too young." Of course, you probably won't hear these messages until somebody first points them out to you. Perception is influenced by expectation, and expectation is affected by what others prime you for. Since most people do not listen to their music backward, the belief in such messages seems to be predicated upon one or two false notions. One, either the brain can be influenced subliminally by garbled words whose meaning is directly grasped by the subconscious, or two, the conscious mind translates clear speech into reverse speech where the true meaning is understood by the subconscious mind. In either case, the subconscious mind allegedly then directs the conscious mind to believe bad things or do bad deeds. There is no evidence that such mechanisms exist. The belief in the existence and efficacy of backward satanic messages probably derives from the ancient practice of mocking Christianity by saying prayers backwards at the witch's Sabbath. The belief is mainly popular among certain fundamentalist preachers who cannot look at anything without wondering how Satan is involved. Perception is heavily influenced by one's belief system. We not only see what we want to see and hear, we see what we expect to see. The Beatles used tapes played backward for musical effect in some of their recordings, though they allegedly put in backward or subliminal messages announcing Paul McCartney's death when he was much alive. Jimmy Page, guitarist and occultist, is said to have inserted the backward message, "Here's to my sweet Satan," into his Stairway to Heaven song. The former was clearly intentional. The latter is said to be accidental by many of those who have listened before, being told what to listen for. One practical problem emerged with using this backhanded way to communicate. The only way to hear the messages is to destroy your record. Fortunately, the digital age arrived and eliminated that problem while creating another. Now it is first grade simple to find hidden messages in every kind of speech. And now we're going to go to an email from a listener. The listener writes, "Neo, towards the end of your last show, I got disconnected and did not get a chance to respond to your comments on altruism. You said you seem to agree with all other objectivist views, but not with their gripe on altruism. You then proceeded to give examples of what you considered to be acts of altruism, but they were not." Allow me to interrupt his email briefly to give you some background information on altruism. According to the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, altruism is, 1, unselfish regard for or devotion to the welfare of others, and 2, behavior by an animal that is not beneficial to or may be harmful to itself, but that benefits others of its species. What objectivists have done is to redefine the word to mean what they need it to mean. They have redefined it so that any and all human acts can be considered selfish. In effect, they have deleted the word from the language. Now back to the listener's email. He says, "If a soldier risks his life in battle, hopefully it is because he values living free." My response: you cannot assume to know why a soldier risks his life in battle. You gave one reason that you will reduce to a selfish motive. However, there are many other reasons why men will risk their lives in battle. For instance, one may fight to free slaves. Despite knowing he may suffer serious injury or death, he fights for those who cannot fight for themselves because he believes it is right. That fits the definition given above, not the redefinition by objectivists. He continues, such a man would rather die on his feet than to live on his knees. I respond, some men would rather die on their feet than live on their knees, but many other men would rather live as cowards than die as heroes, and many other men will live on their knees if that's what it takes to protect and raise their families. The listener continues, it is not a selfless act, but a completely selfish act to fight for a country that recognizes the concept of individual rights. For example, that recognizes your right to live your own life, liberty, and selfish pursuit of happiness. However fading the concept may be, it is significantly different to live in a country that never had or never will recognize this concept, nor thus the nature of man. My response, the nature of man contains something you left out, evil. While you want to live your own life and pursue liberty and happiness, there have always been, still are, and always will be, those who want to take it all away from you, and they will kill you to get it. Granted, it is in your selfish interest to fight for your country and for your survival, but it is during such conflict when altruism is at its best, as when one soldier sacrifices his life to save the life of his comrade. If I was in a war again, the last person on earth I would want next to me is an objectivist. I might as well be fighting alone. He goes on, in such slave pens, man is asked to sacrifice his life for the will of God, for the welfare of others, or for any arbitrarily decided collective will. All ideals that are variants of the mysticist, altruist, collectivist axis. Irregardless of war or peacetime, in such primitive societies, man lives his life and dies not for his own sake, but for the ends of others deemed proper by the state. My response, they are not asked to sacrifice. They are told to sacrifice. That is not altruism. He continues, if a woman spends money to buy a toy for her child that she could have used otherwise on clothes for herself, she is not being altruistic but selfish. My reply, reread the definition. If you have to redefine the word to make it fit your belief, then it is time to re-examine your belief, not the definition. He continues, she values the health and well-being of her child more than she does the clothes, and she finds virtue in achieving those values through the happiness of her child. My response, altruism is not negated by the fact that you derived satisfaction or happiness from your sacrifice. He continues, but if she buys the toy for her neighbor's child and gives her child, which she values more, nothing, that is an act of altruism. My response, but according to what you said previously, if she values the well-being of the neighbor's child and finds virtue in achieving that value through the happiness of the neighbor's child, then how can that be altruism? He continues, these are all examples of finding the virtue of selfishness, which is the basis for the objectivist ethics. My response, it is not necessary to find the virtue of selfishness. Evolution has already provided that for us, as well as every other living creature on the planet. It is not a virtue, but a characteristic of all living things. He continues, now it's understandable that altruism is the moral code that has long been associated with the message of goodwill and kindness. Below are two paragraphs from the objectivist writer Craig Biddle that nicely characterizes the trajectory of altruism in America. And here are the paragraphs. Although America was founded on the principle of individual rights, Americans since the founding have increasingly embraced a moral code that is diametrically opposed to that principle, the morality of altruism. The notion that being moral consists in self-sacrifice and serving others. My response, what country is Biddle living in? We must be watching different TV news stations. The country I see is increasingly more selfish. Altruism is rarer every day. Out of many, I will offer one proof. Before Ayn Rand, there were no objectivists. Now there are many. Biddle goes on, we repeatedly hear, don't be selfish, put others first. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Volunteer to serve in your community. Sacrifice for the greater good. And so on. This is the morality that surrounded all of us growing up and that still surrounds us. It is the morality taught in churches, synagogues, and schools, offered in books, movies, and on TV, and encouraged by most parents. And it is the morality by reference to which our presidential candidates build political platforms, clinch nominations, win elections, and govern the country. My response. Biddle has to be incredibly naive to believe that people vote for candidates who ask them to sacrifice. No one does that. People vote for candidates who promise them the most stuff. This stuff has to come from somewhere. It comes from those who supported the loser. For someone to vote against their own self-interest simply because they believe that their candidate is wrong is extremely rare and altruistic. Biddle continues, although few Americans strive consistently to practice the morality of self-sacrifice, because consistently acting in a self-sacrificial manner is wholly contrary to the pursuit of happiness. I respond, Biddle assumes to know what makes everyone happy. He assumes too much. Many people do find happiness in self-sacrifice, and that is something he will apparently never understand. Biddle says, most Americans have, to a significant extent, accepted this morality as true. My response, Biddle, are you sure we're talking about the same America? The same America where pedestrians walk right by a woman while she is being mugged at noon in downtown Manhattan? Is that the America you're referring to? Maybe we live in different Americas. I'll admit, I would rather live in yours. Biddle concludes, and because Americans generally want to do what they think is right, their consequent striving for virtue in this regard and their corresponding support for political candidates who call for sacrifice has been and is leading to the demise of America. My response, I can think of many things that are leading to the demise of America, but as I already pointed out, your claim that people support candidates who demand sacrifice is false. They support those who represent their selfish interests, something I know you can relate to. And now we go to the next segment of the show, the science segment. And today's topic, scientists get images of a planet with a sun-like star. This was from 3 months ago, September 16th. Scientists have snapped the first images of a planet outside our solar system that is orbiting a star very much like the sun. Nearly all of the roughly 300 so-called extrasolar planets discovered to date have been detected using indirect methods, such as changes observed in a star when a planet orbits directly in front of it from the perspective of Earth. But in findings announced on Monday, University of Toronto scientists said they used the Gemini North Telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii to take direct pictures of the planet, which is about the size of Jupiter, but with 8 times the mass. It is also much hotter than Jupiter, they said. This planet and the star it seems to orbit are located in our Milky Way galaxy about 500 light-years from Earth. A light-year is about 6 trillion miles, or the distance light travels in a year. It's always been a goal to take a picture of a planet around another star. The challenge, of course, is that planets are much, much fainter than stars. Of all known extrasolar planets, this one is orbiting the furthest from its star. It is located roughly 11 times further from its star than Neptune, the outermost planet in our solar system. They said they are working to confirm that the planet is indeed orbiting this star as it appears, but it may take up to 2 years to get that data. The star is very typical. It's like the sun, just younger. But the planet is quite unusual. It's on the high end of the mass of the extrasolar planets found so far, and it's also very far away from its star. Before this, the only planets or similar objects that have been directly imaged outside of the solar system were either free-floating in space and not orbiting a star, or orbiting a brown dwarf, a failed star that did not reach mass necessary to spark the nuclear fusion typical of a star. Scientists said they benefited from technology that reduces distortions from turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere. The scientists have evidence of water and carbon monoxide in the planet's atmosphere. The planet is not thought to be a good candidate for extraterrestrial life because it appears to be a gas giant, a type of planet inhospitable to life, and because it is too young. The star is considered a newborn, forming an estimated 5 million years ago, while our sun is about 4.5 billion years old. The next segment of the show, The Arena Goes Abroad. Today we go to Malaysia, where the Malaysian Islamic body bans yoga for Muslims. This is from November 22, 2008. Malaysia's top Islamic body, fresh from banning tomboys, has issued an edict that prohibits Muslims from practicing yoga, saying that elements of Hinduism in the ancient Indian exercise could corrupt them. The National Fatwa Council's chairman, Hussein, said, "Many Muslims fail to understand that yoga's ultimate aim is to be one with a god of a different religion, an explanation disputed by many practitioners, who say yoga need not have a religious element. We are of the view that yoga, which originates from Hinduism, combines physical exercise, religious elements, chanting, and worshiping for the purpose of achieving inner peace and ultimately to be one with God." News of the yoga ban prompted activists to wonder what the council will ban next. Gyms? Most gyms have men and women together. Will that not be allowed anymore? The edict reflects the growing influence of conservative Islam in Malaysia, a multi-ethnic country of 27 million people where the majority Muslim Malays lost seats in March elections and where minority ethnic Chinese and mostly Hindu ethnic Indians have been clamoring for more rights. Recently, the council said girls who act like boys violate Islam's tenets. The government has also occasionally made similar conservative moves, banning the use of the word Allah by non-Muslims earlier this year, saying it would confuse Muslims. Well, it confuses me. Analysts say the fatwa could be the result of insecurity among Malay Muslims after their party, in power since 1957, saw its parliamentary majority greatly reduced in elections because of gains by multiracial opposition parties. Malay Muslims make up about 2/3 of the country's 27 million people. About 25% of the population is ethnic Chinese, and 8% is ethnic Indian, most of whom are Hindu. They are making a stand. They are saying, "We will not give way." But many Muslims abide by the edicts out of deference. And for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, Friedrich Nietzsche born 1844, died 1900 at the age of 55. He was a 19th century German philosopher and classical philologist. He wrote critical texts on religion, morality, contemporary culture, philosophy, and science, using a distinctive German language style and displaying a fondness for metaphor and aphorism. Nietzsche's influence remains substantial within and beyond philosophy, notably in existentialism and postmodernism. Nietzsche began his career as a classical philologist before turning to philosophy. At the age of 24, he was appointed to the chair of classical philology at the University of Basel, the youngest individual ever to have held this position, but resigned in 1879 because of health problems, which would plague him most of his life. In 1889, he exhibited symptoms of serious mental illness, living out his remaining years in the care of his mother and sister until his death in 1900. And now for the quotes from Friedrich Nietzsche. The first quote is very brief. Great intellects are skeptical. His second quote, there is not sufficient love and goodness in the world to permit us to give some of it away to imaginary beings. And now I'm going to unmute Jamal. Welcome into the skeptic arena.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, fine.
So what brings you into the arena?
Well, I saw the topic of the show, and I came here, then I heard you talking about different things, and I find it interesting.
But you missed the original topic that you came in for, right? The backward satanic messages?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, what you can do is, I guess you're familiar with TalkShoe, all you have to do is wait a couple hours till I've edited this and I've posted it, and then you can download it and you can listen to the beginning, and then you can hear that part.
Yeah. But the other things I've heard, I think is interesting.
Well, thank you. Every week
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, why you're saying all these things, what makes you talk about such things in such way?
The purpose of this broadcast is to help other people develop critical thinking skills, and that also includes developing the host's critical thinking skills, because through the dialogue we can help each other learn how to think rationally, and in a world that's probably 95% irrational, if we don't start getting the world to think rationally, things are looking like they're going to get pretty dim.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think you're right, but I have a few problems the way you explain your theories.
Okay.
Especially the language you choose.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has got a few problems.
Go ahead and say what they are.
Like the use of the word belief. I don't know, and what sort of meaning you have in your mind when you use the word belief.
What's your definition?
Well, I've got my own definition, but I'm curious to know how you define belief.
I define it in terms of the comparison between rational and irrational people. Belief for a rational person is based on evidence. After weighing the evidence, the rational person will draw a conclusion. Irrational people think completely backwards than rational people do. They start with the conclusion. They already have their belief. And then when evidence is presented to them, they will discard, ignore any evidence that does not agree with what they want to believe. And any evidence that supports their belief will be automatically accepted without challenge. And so I see belief as falling into two separate categories, and that gets back to the purpose of this show. to try to switch the percentages, as I see them in this world, from 95% irrational to 95% rational, so that people learn to weigh the evidence before forming their belief. But that's not what I see happening. I see belief formed first, and then the evidence is sifted through and weighed based on how it fits into their belief.
Well, yeah. But if you've noticed that a person who is here in this room, you know, he posted something that all belief is a form of linguistic pathology.
What's your question?
My question is that belief is just a word that you use. How can you define belief?
Well, I just did.
Okay. Now, do you believe in anything?
We would be here for years if I started listing the things I believe in.
Yeah.
Would you like one? You want me to give you one example?
Yeah, just
okay.
One.
Okay, I believe in the law of gravity.
Hmm. What makes you think that gravity exists?
Well, I'll tell you what. You put your phone down for a second and go out up on your roof, and you challenge that theory, and then if you can come back to the phone and tell me that it was wrong, then we'll continue the conversation.
Yeah, but it's right that we'll fall down. Okay, it's a sort of experience. But what is gravity? I mean, why it is happening, I don't think anybody knows. It's just one experience that we have given a definition to that experience. I mean, we have got our own theories about these phenomena that we see. But if you actually believe that it exists, you know, the word belief and the word gravity, you know, these are just words.
They're just words until you step off the edge of your roof. Then those words become a very hard reality. And if I believe in gravity and you don't, I can assure you that the results will be much more than words.
No, but what's the point of believing in that?
Well, it keeps you from jumping off the roof. That's what the point is.
No, but I know that I'll fall down.
How do you know? How do you know? If you don't believe in gravity, how do you know you're going to...
Because of my previous experience.
Okay, well, there you go. Then you agree with me and you don't even realize it.
Maybe.
We don't have a disagreement.
Right.
We're in total agreement.
But I have got disagreement that you're using the word, you know. It's just your assumption.
If you don't want to call it by a name, don't call it by a name. Just don't jump off the roof. It doesn't matter to me whether you call it gravity or you call it Vishnu. You can call it whatever you want or you can call it nothing. Just don't jump off the roof.
Yeah. I mean, it has got its practical problems.
Well, that's what science is all about. Science is about the real world, not about the spirit world, which we've never been able to discover exists. All we've been able to find is the real world, and so that's all we can go on until we find evidence of that there's something more. And if evidence comes up that there's something more, then it'll be added to science.
Yeah, that's right. But when you theorize in the domain of language about the experience, you give certain words. I mean, you come up with terminology to define that experience, whatever you experience. But it's just your experience.
If you want to go back to prehistoric man and just give up language, that's your, you know, no one's stopping you. Language is something humans have developed, and as a result, we're now landing on other planets. But if language bothers you that much and you don't want to use it, don't use it.
No, I'm not against the language. I mean, that's the only tool we have, you know. But, you know, use of language in a proper way, you know, in a meaningful way.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us what a proper way is.
I mean, like the word belief, itself is a problem. You know, when you use the word belief, that I believe in something.
Well, what word would you replace it with?
I don't know.
Well, then, when you find out...
I'd rather not use it.
Okay, then don't use it.
And I'd rather use the word assumption.
Wait, what?
It's just my theory, assumption.
Assumption?
You know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'd rather use that?
Experience something.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, and but I don't believe. Believe, I think, is a linguistic pathology.
Okay.
Because once you believe in something, I mean, it becomes that you're stuck in a...
irrational people. No, irrational people become stuck because they refuse to relinquish their beliefs. Rational people, like scientists, when they get new evidence that disproves their belief, they change their belief. And so they are not stuck. So I agree with you about people being stuck in their beliefs, but what you're referring to are irrational thinking people. That's why the importance of my show. You asked me in the beginning the purpose of my show, and you've just given a reason to the listeners what the value is to this show, and that is to provide rational thinking to people so that they will learn that when they have a belief, that you don't have to defend it at all costs. When new evidence comes in, it's not going to kill you to say you were wrong. When new evidence comes in that shows that for whatever reason you had a false belief, then you change that belief and you now have a new belief. And you may have to change it 5 times. But there's nothing wrong with that.
No, but why don't you use the word theory instead of belief?
Well, you can.
I mean, you can have your own theory and I can have my own theory about anything. And we have language, you know, for making our theories. But
well,
it's just a theory.
Well, you're okay. Well, you just prefer a different word.
Reality in the domain of language.
Okay, you know, I'm not going to argue over which word to use. If you prefer the word theory, that's fine with me. In fact, I agree that theory and belief could be considered synonyms.
No, but they're exactly two different words, you know, because you associate different meanings with them. Mostly religious people associate a different sort of meaning, that when they say they believe in God, you know, what is that? They haven't seen anything, and they just say we believe, and they think that it's real. It's the language that makes you think that whatever you are saying is real. But these are just words.
Well, these things that you're calling just words are powerful enough to have caused the death of many people. Words are very powerful.
Yeah, I'm no doubt about it. They're very powerful. But once you realize that these are just words, and we take them as real. I mean, but actually they're not. These are just words, and we have associated certain sort of meanings with them. So all our thinking process is through the words. We use words for our thinking.
Have you got a better idea?
I mean...
what would you rather use?
I will use words, okay, but I will use them in a more sensible way. If I'm aware that it's just the language, I mean, these are just words, and we have created these words. We have given certain meanings to these words. I mean, it's not real.
Okay, so you think you have better sense and use of words than I do. I have no problem with that. You probably do. That's not a problem for me. The fact that you think you use words better than me is fine. That doesn't bother me at all. You probably do.
Well, maybe, but again, the very basic issue is that all these words are, these are just words made by humans, and some words like the word freedom. Okay, do you think it is a real world? I mean, any such freedom exists?
I don't know. Why don't you ask a slave and find out?
Yeah, but the word freedom, like you say, when you use it, that I'm living in a free world.
I don't know what world that is. That's not this world.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think there's any such thing as reality within the domain of language. I mean, we have our own theories, and words are, you know, they're just, you know, different maps that we have made for different territories, you know, and we identify the territory with the map, you know. So it's the same within the domain of language.
And where does that get you?
It means that these are words are just maps within the domain of language.
Okay.
And you know, there is no real or true map, you know.
How do you know?
We've got different... Yeah, I mean, it's obvious once you see it that, like, we have got different maps for different territories, and they're all useful maps, but there is no true map, you know.
So, how do you know?
Because I know that we have made these maps for identifying the territory. Territory is a reality, it exists. You know, but maps we have made, and they keep on changing as the territory keeps on changing.
Why does change bother you so much?
It doesn't bother me, but once you take a map as the true map, when you use the word "it is the true map," then definitely a sense comes through this sentence that all other maps are wrong. I mean, it's the true map.
Well, if it is the true map, then all other different maps are wrong.
No, but the thing is that there's no true map.
How do you know?
I mean, we have it's obvious because we have created these maps. Like, okay, if we've got a street map, you know, one map that shows all the streets, and that there are other maps that show different, you know, buildings, you know, and if you have only seen a street map in your life, and you say it is the true map, and if I say no, there are other maps that exist, but you don't agree with me because you've just seen one map, say it is the true map.
There's one way to find out which one's the true map. Follow the directions and find out which one gets you to your destination.
Yeah, I mean, maps are useful, but there is not a single true map.
How do you know?
It's obvious. I mean, because we have created these maps. How they can be real? Did them in the domain of language.
If I create a map, if I give you directions to my home, and you follow those directions and you get to my home, how do you figure that is not a true map?
I mean, it's... Yeah, it's a useful map.
Well, how do you figure it's not a how do you figure it's not a true map if you actually get to my home when you've never been here before?
Yeah.
Well, that makes it a true map.
Yeah, that makes it a useful map.
No, I mean, no.
I'm going to use the word.
And it also makes all the other maps false. Because if they
it doesn't make anything true or false.
How do you figure if you get a map to my house from someone else and it gives you the wrong directions? How do you figure that is not false?
I mean, I mean the word true and false. These are the words that are problematic.
For you they are, but they're not problematic for the rest, for the people who live in the real world.
Yeah, but most of the people are, you know, they're unconscious thinkers. They don't...
Now you're redefining the word conscious, and that's a logical fallacy. You cannot, you cannot redefine words to make them mean what you need them to mean. Conscious has a very specific meaning, and when you're talking about people being unconscious, you're not using the dictionary definition, you're using your own special definition.
I have my own theory about consciousness, but it's not the true theory. It's just a way of talking about it, and you can have your own way of talking about it, but there's not a single true or real definition.
I'd rather stick to things that are more solid. Conscious is a hard subject to discuss, but something...
It's a reification. I mean, these are abstract nouns. I mean, you can't put conscious in a bucket.
Right.
You know?
Although they're getting closer to doing that, the more they're mapping the human brain, the closer they're coming to actually doing just that.
I think Heron Stone is here.
There's a lot of people here.
Mike.
Yeah, we got a pretty good crowd.
Yeah, and he's asking for the mic. If you unmute him, I think he can... participate in this conversation.
Well, I take people one at a time, and I don't want to shortchange you. You deserve to have your time, and then he can have his. So go ahead and continue.
I'm done.
Thank you for coming into the Skeptic Arena. It was great having you.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, Heron Stone, you've been unmuted.
Hey, Neo. It's Heron. Nothing fancy. Nothing like Heron or anything.
I like where the name... I looked up the name, and it came from ancient Greece, and that guy was pretty impressive, the guy who invented the steam engine.
His name was Heron?
About 1,800 years or 2,000 years before we got the steam engine, the Greeks would have had it. Yeah.
And it was Heron, huh?
That was...
Good, I didn't even know that.
That was amazing. That, I mean, what stopped society? In my opinion, it was religion. Although I don't mean to be offensive to religious believers,
be offensive. Religion is a form of pathology. Let's face it.
So
a form of mental illness.
So I'm sure you want to pinch hit for Jamal. So go ahead.
No, I just wanted to pursue this issue of maps and territories because I want to clarify that a little bit. When you brought up you responded by talking about an inaccurate map to your house as opposed to an accurate map to your house, and therefore saying that that the one was true and the other were false. I wouldn't use that terminology. I'd talk about accuracy, but I'd go further and say that there are other kinds of maps, like for instance topographical maps, which are completely different, look nothing like a street map. And nobody in his right mind would ask, given a topo map and a street map, which is the one true map? That's nonsense. They're useful for different circumstances. If you're going to buy flood insurance, well, you want a topo map. If you're looking for a way to get to work, you're going to get a street map. And you're not going to have to pick which is the one true map. You keep them both. And there may be other maps.
Well, he's the one who brought up one true map. That wasn't me.
That was in relationship to the idea of theories being true.
Okay.
And that's what I'm saying is that theories are really nothing more than maps. They're representations in symbolic form, and you can have more than one theory for the very same phenomenon, and they don't have to be in conflict with each other, even though they can be different. For instance, the wave and particle theories of matter, which ended friendships in the late 19th century, and people argued back and forth that electrons were waves. No, they're particles. And they were laboring under the false assumption that a particular theory, if it's correct, then competing theories must in fact be wrong. And that's not true. It doesn't follow at all. You don't judge a theory against another theory. You judge a theory against the evidence. And in fact, what they found was that if you think about electrons as particles, you can do experiments that verify that they are indeed particles. However, if you do other experiments, assuming them to be waves, well, then they're waves, and they're both true. That's a universal truth about the nature of maps themselves, the concept that any map can be the one and only true map is absurd on the face of it. We are only limited by our creativity and our ability to create maps or theories.
Well, let's take gravity.
Well, there is no gravity if you've studied Einstein. It's just curved space. I mean, they still use the word gravity, but there is no gravity.
Well, they use the word to represent a force.
Well, they do presently. I suspect they'll have to give that up before too much longer. You must admit that current atomic theory is close to becoming useless. It's so arcane and complex that it's like the old orreries trying to prop up, you know, the the geocentric model of the universe. You know,
it's not that way to astrophysicists.
Oh, no, and of course the orreries weren't that way to people who spent their lives trying to figure out how you could make it look like the Earth is the center of the universe.
Right.
They thought that's perfectly reasonable, and they had all these circles within circles within circles, and they were able to predict, the movement of the planets, you know. But it turned out that that theory... Well, that there was a better, simpler theory, you know, that...
So that theory was false.
No, it wasn't false. It was just a theory. It worked okay until somebody came along with an even better, more elegant theory.
It proved the original theory false.
No, well, that's your opinion. I think it superseded it.
Because if you still believe that the Earth is the center of the solar system, and you don't want to admit that that is false.
No, but there's no quarrel between that, and it's perfectly, you can see the Earth as the center of the universe, and that's a perfectly reasonable way to think about it. The math sucks, doing that for trying to plot orbits to Mars or anything, that wouldn't work.
Well, that's the whole point. That it's false.
No, it's not the whole point. No, it's not the whole point at all. The point is, you can pick a point of view and then build a theory on it. I can build an egocentric model of the universe. The whole universe revolves around my ego. And that's just as true.
Let's get back to false theories. What we've wound up in is a semantic battle over the word false. But
that's an important battle, I think. I think that's a really important battle. The idea of the one true theory, I think, is indefensible. I don't think you're nearly skeptical enough.
If you prove that the Earth is not the center of the solar system...
Can't prove that.
Well, we already have.
No, we haven't. We've proved that we have models that predict the behavior of planets and the data that we've got. That's a hell of a lot easier than trying to do it with the geocentric model. Geocentric model is very limited to certain sort of earthly configurations. The minute you include a larger universe, then the heliocentric or galactocentric or clump-centric models are more useful.
Well, I said specifically the solar system.
Okay, well, but what about the galaxy?
No, I don't want to change the subject. We were talking about the solar system.
Well, yes, well, that's what I'm saying, though. Is that
now you're trying to change the subject. I don't want to change the subject. I want to focus on one thing at a time, and
okay,
right now it's
the
solar system.
All right, for the solar system, then, the solar system isn't even an applicable phenomenon in a geocentric model. The whole universe is the system of the Earth at that point, because everything revolves around the Earth. The solar system is meaningless.
No, I don't know what you mean by meaningless.
Well, solar system, by definition, is a heliocentric system. I mean, sun,
yes,
solar, helios.
Right. Yeah, so to say that the Earth is the center of our solar system is wrong.
No, I know. I would say, you're right. Okay, the solar system, it might be a less than optimum way of saying it.
Holy Christ. It's wrong, period. There's no one on earth. Well, yeah, there are there still are Christians that believe it, but
I don't understand why you can't accept the fact that you can have different naps that are created for different purposes that can be equally true in different domains.
Because
the geocentric model isn't really a scientific theory in the sense that the heliocentric model is. It has a different purpose from a different time.
Well, I'm not interested. I'm talking about the solar system being centered around the sun. Any other theory about our solar system is pure, is whether you want to use the word false or wrong or all the words or belief, all the words you guys don't like, you can pick a word and substitute it for the words I use that you don't like if you want. I don't care.
No, that's not the issue. I mean, that you're right. That would be trivial. That's not the point. The point is really to debunk the concept of the true theory. That's the problem I have, that there can be such a thing as the true theory.
And, well, I agree. In science, there never is absolute certainty. That's only found in religion.
That's my case. I rest my case. That's exactly the point. Well, all we have is our best current theory.
Well,
don't know what the hell somebody's going to come up with tomorrow.
Well, you should have said that at the beginning, because I've never said anything different than that.
Oh, yes, you have. When you talk about the true theory, that implies the end of the search.
Well, that was Jamal that said the true theory. He brought it up. I didn't use that term.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm saying that the theory that whatever theory, like right now, whether it be gravity or the center of the solar system, I don't know if it's the true theory. I don't know.
Yes, you do know. It's not the true theory. It's the best current theory we have.
Well, those are the words I would have used. That's how I would describe it.
Oh, okay, good. Then we are in agreement then. Good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we are. Just like Jamal and I were actually in agreement, but it's the same thing that you and I and him and I had. We get tangled up in the words.
That's really crucial. That's really crucial. That's what science does, is science settles on vocabulary. That's why in the year 1800, Volta created his first battery, but there were no iPods, you know, and 200 years later we're talking on Skype, and what changed was language, not electricity. Over the 200 years, very dedicated individuals took a hard, cold look at electrical phenomena and literally invented new vocabulary precisely defined.
Well, you have to in order to communicate, unless you want to go back to being cavemen, you have to use vocabulary to pass on ideas.
Yes.
That's what separates us from the animals.
That's why we have to be picky about our vocabulary. That's why the word belief, I think, really needs to be relegated to a form of pathology. It's a sickness. Believe in rationalism, and that's just as stupid as believing in Jesus.
Oh, I take issue with that completely. Go ahead and prove what you just said.
I'm afraid I'm not. I don't think there's anything I can say that would convince you that what I just said has merit. So I'm not even going to try.
Yeah, I think you probably got that one right, because it can't be what you said. I don't see how you could possibly prove it.
No, of course not. It takes to prove something like that.
Evidence.
What I just said isn't even a provable hypothesis.
Well, that's rationalists only deal in what is provable in the real world.
Real world. Okay, yeah, all right.
Anything else is
irrelevant. You actually
irrelevant.
Believe in the real world, that there's a real objective reality out there that's independent of our observation of it, and that it's out there, and that it exists, and that it has properties independent of us.
Yeah, I'll give you the same challenge I gave Jamal. You put your phone down and go up on the roof, and then if you can come back and continue this conversation, then we'll have a whole different direction to go in.
Well, the thing is, you call it the real world. I would call it one reality. Those rules do apply. That's why I'm not going to go jump off.
You accept that challenge, and you'll find out it's the only real world.
No, it's not the only real world. It's one real world that I inhabit. I inhabit a couple of different, quite real worlds. We're in one of them right now.
Well, that's what religious people say. They're going to go to heaven when they die.
Let's not bring them into it.
How are you different?
I don't believe.
Well, you just told me you live in different dimensions, so of course you believe. your own statement.
Let me be more precise then. I have various maps for my experience, and I have several different maps that apply for different reasons. When I'm operating as a scientist, I use a map very similar to yours. But that's not the only way I operate. Science is one mode that I can be in. I'm also a poet. I'm also an artist. And science is almost irrelevant in those domains.
Well, what you're calling domains, I would just call hobbies.
Okay. Well, congratulations. You have the handle on reality, then.
Well, I would just say I use Webster's Dictionary, and you've created your own.
I consult dictionaries. I'm not bound by them.
Well, that's the problem. That's why when you communicate with people who are bound by them, there's no way to connect.
You're right. Absolutely. You're right. That's the problem. Yeah. I talk to people who are bound by dictionary definitions.
Right.
And can't see beyond that and see that those are just the ways that they were programmed to think. Then you're right. It does hamper, but I'm aware of that problem, and I can avoid it if I need to.
Tonight you didn't need to, did you?
I'm feeling sort of feisty tonight, I guess.
I love it. No, that's what the arena's all about.
Yeah.
You are epitomizing what the original purpose of the Skeptic Arena was all about.
Interesting that you would think that because I see my whole criticism of you is that you're not nearly skeptical enough.
You couldn't get much closer to 100% skeptic than me, but okay.
Yes, you could. You could be skeptical about the entire process of skepticism.
Okay.
Well, no, it's a serious point. We're brought up and hypnotized as children by our language machines and brought into certain understandings and ways of thinking about our experience. And by the time we're 8 or 10, we have completely bought into a metaphysic that is insane.
What you call being hypnotized by a machine is what most people call learning to communicate.
Yes, that's right. That's what most people call it. I agree with you. I know I'm in the minority in suggesting that 98% of language monkeys are essentially living in a linguistically induced hypnotic trance, where they mistake the story in their head that they've constructed out of language for the way the world really, really is. And I would say that is a form of insanity. Well, not insanity. It's just an age-old trance that humans are subject to. And whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist or whatever, people have these stories programmed into their brains, or an atheist or an Amway salesman, actually, for that matter. And they quickly come to accept that that story isn't just a way of thinking about the world, but the way the world really is.
You use 98% as a figure for language monkeys. I use 95% as a figure for irrational thinking.
I mean, pretty much the same thing, I think, yes.
And as far as revealing the real world, I think the best system that has ever been found for doing that is science. And
I agree.
I don't know of anything else.
I just wouldn't use the word the real world. I'd just say science is, so far, the best methodology we've discovered for making sense out of our experience in one limited domain of that experience. I mean, there's a lot to our experience that just simply has nothing to do with, I wouldn't say nothing, that's going a little too far, but, you know, that's really outside the domain of science, at least at present. But that's changing quickly. Like I said, I think we are on the verge, I suspect, of a technology of consciousness over the next 30 to 50 years. And that's going to change everything.
Okay, those are beliefs or hopes that you have.
I know, that's an assumption that I've made. Based on my reading and looking around, I am assuming that there is a technology of consciousness emerging.
Well, the next step after assumption of a hypothesis is gathering of evidence or testing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's come at, I mean, it's the evidence that has led me to that. It's not the next step. They all overlap each other simultaneously, you know. theories and experience, and sometimes experience leads the way, sometimes theory leads the way, but they all have to go together in the end. And I don't have adequate language to talk about this.
Okay, so what's your evidence? Give me one piece of evidence.
In the year 1800, there was no technology of electricity. There was folk wisdom about various, you know, things, and people could make things happen, but there was no unified theory that gave them any power over electricity. And now here we are talking on the Internet, and what changed was they developed precise language over the last 200 years that allowed us to gain control in that domain. And the science of psychology began in earnest around 100 years ago, and we're now, just in the last 10, 15 years, actually really beginning to collect data and come up with new theories, and I think that that's a pretty good analogy. I think that before too much longer, we are going to have sufficient new language to develop a technology of consciousness that will give us as much power and control over our mental states as we now have over electricity.
That was a nice speech, but you didn't give me one piece of evidence that I asked for.
Well, listen, if you don't see what I'm saying, a piece of evidence isn't going to help.
Well, that's what religious people say. That's exactly what a creationist would have said.
Perhaps, yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm not, you know, like I say, if the evidence...
No, science doesn't work that way.
You don't tell me how science works. Are you what kind of scientist are you?
Science works by evidence, and if you don't have evidence and all you've got is speeches, then you're no different than a creationist. If you've got evidence, you need to present evidence.
I'm curious. What science is? What scientist? I'm just me. What science? Wondering what you're. Where you get these notions of science. I think there are many different kinds of science. Being a psychologist or a linguist or a physicist or a biologist entails quite different kinds of attitudes about proof and all sorts of stuff, you know?
When people don't have the evidence like you just didn't have, the first thing they do is they go to personal attack, and that's just what you did.
Personally attacking you. I was just asking you, telling me what science is. I'm just curious what science you've studied.
It's irrelevant to the conversation. I could be a gardener, and it wouldn't matter. You're trying to distract the listeners from the fact that you don't have any evidence, and you're trying to move the conversation.
What would you consider to be evidence for? First of all, the theory. You're asking for theory for evidence that there is going to be an emerging technology of consciousness. Is that you're asking for evidence to support that? What I just said there? Is that what you want?
You made a speech, and I asked you for evidence, because you said there was evidence for what
okay.
you believed.
What is specifically... No, I don't believe anything. I make assumptions, please. Quit putting those words in my mouth. But you want evidence to support what theory?
You said you had evidence. I didn't... That's
what
I asked
you. Well, I'm asking you what theory it is you want evidence.
Well, you're the one who said you had evidence for what you assume.
Well, I have to just go back and listen to this because I have no idea. I can't believe that I said I have evidence. That doesn't sound like something I would say. But maybe I did. If I said that, I might have misspoken.
Okay. So if it's just an assumption, that's fine. I have no problem with that if you're just making an assumption. But rationalists only accept or believe what is proven through evidence. And anything else is... what?
It actually works.
What's that?
I think that's a really naive understanding of the way science really works, driven by logic. You know, it's part of it. That's part of the puzzle. There's also obsession and inspiration, you know, part of that. But it certainly doesn't drive the whole system.
More personal attacks are not going to replace the lack of evidence. I mean, insults and personal attacks are
evidence
exactly what people... That's what people do when they don't have facts.
I don't think I'm attacking. I'm sorry if you take it as an attack.
Well, when you call a person naive, what would you... You don't consider that an attack?
No, I consider it a description.
I don't think you would enjoy it if I called you naive.
Well, it depends on who's saying it and why and okay. The circumstances. I may or may not accept that.
So another, yeah. So you were personally attacking, and which is okay. But when
I don't mean it. I'm quite serious. I think it's a very naive understanding of science to think that evidence is what drives the whole system. It's one aspect of it. It's near the end of it, too.
It's the most important aspect of science. Without evidence.
No. Vision, creativity, love, obsession. Those are equally important. I don't think we can talk about one of them. I mean, is your brain more important than your heart or your liver? Nonsense. You need them all.
All those things you mentioned have nothing to do with science or evidence.
It's an analogy. Science is a complex undertaking that has many subsystems. Like a human body does. It's silly to pick one of them and say that it's the most important one. That's just nonsense.
Well, now you're attacking a straw man because I never said anything about bodily organs being more important than others.
No, you said evidence is the most important part of science.
It definitely.
I made an analogy to biological organisms, suggesting that you can't really say that one organ is more important than another.
That's called a logical fallacy, a false analogy. You don't need to make analogies. You can address my issue directly. My issue was evidence. Instead of creating a false analogy, which has nothing to do with the subject, you should direct the subject, which is evidence.
I'm not sure it has nothing to do with it. You don't accept it. I got it. You don't accept that analogy as being useful. I think that analogy is quite instructive.
Not useful, relevant. I don't think it was relevant.
Well, again, you don't think it's relevant. I do think it's relevant. And where do we settle that? Certainly not in the domain of evidence.
The only thing that matters to science is evidence. Everything else is bullshit and it walks.
Ah, okay. Well, that's your definition.
No,
that's late in the game. That's late in the game. Not what starts science, what gets it going. Evidence is, if anything, it's the last little chink in it. It's absolutely important, fundamental, but it's certainly not the most important part of science.
Of course it is. Without evidence, you don't have science. You have
nothing. Without a creative theory making in the domain of language, there's no need for evidence.
Why not?
But you got to have a theory before you can go out and collect evidence.
Not true. If you go out and you find a cave painting, you may not have had a theory about people living 100,000 years ago, but
and
you find you
we're
can find
about that. The simplicity. I mean, you're right. You can wander into something that you have no idea. You can note it, take down the data, and collect the data.
Many discoveries have been made like that. Electricity was one with Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin hardly discovered electricity. Give me a break. Electricity has knowledge, folk wisdom about certain aspects of electricity has been around for a couple thousand years.
They weren't able to do anything until they were able to harness it.
That's right. Not until scientists began to develop new and precise language did we turn all that ancient folk wisdom into technology.
Well, it wasn't the language. It was the devices that they created.
Well, it was both. Without language, they wouldn't have created those devices. They had to conceive of that stuff first. That conception is done in language.
Well, it can be done in any language.
Yes, any language.
Right. So the language is irrelevant. It's the device.
No, it's not irrelevant. Just because it can be done in any language doesn't make it irrelevant. Just means you need a language to conceive of things. Without language, I mean, gorillas and dogs don't have science.
Right, then we're back in the case.
In fact, language isn't even enough in science. You need written language.
But you're against this, like a dictionary where you're bound to a dictionary. I thought you were against that.
No, I'm not against that. What I'm in favor of is acknowledging that we invent dictionaries. They're very useful, but we shouldn't be bound by them. We should use them intelligently.
Well, you don't want to be bound by a dictionary because then you can make words mean anything you need them to mean.
Well, for the purpose of a given discussion, yes, you need to be able to have that flexibility, especially when you talk about the kinds of things we're talking about. It's really important to, otherwise, well, yeah, these are serious issues. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I'm not explaining it as well as I wish I could.
I thought you did a pretty good job, actually.
Well, I'm not happy with it. I'm rarely happy with what I have to say, though, so that's okay.
No, it was great having you in the arena. That's the whole purpose, is for the host, for the listeners, for everyone to improve their critical thinking skills by sharing ideas. But I've gone way over my time, and I'm going to have to end it now.
Well, thanks a lot for doing this. I've seen you here before. I suggest that, I hope, I imagine, that you will continue doing it. Good work.
And as always, you are always welcome in the skeptic arena.
Thank you. I will leave you at this point. Bye.
Okay.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.